This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents Intuitive Eating, a revolutionary program that works, by Evelyn Triboli, MSRD, and Elise Resch, MSRD, FADA, CEDRD. This book is read by Pam Ward. To all of our clients and patients who have taught us so much. Notice, this book is intended as a reference volume only, not as a medical manual. It is not a substitute for any treatment that may have been prescribed by your doctor. If you suspect that you have a medical problem, we urge you to seek competent help. Keep in mind that nutritional needs vary from person to person, depending upon age, sex, health status, and total diet. The information discussed here is intended to help you make informed decisions about your eating and health. Forward. This, the brain's integrity function, illuminates how reasoning, once thought to be a purely logical mode of thinking, is in fact dependent on the non-rational processing of our bodies. Daniel Siegel, MD, MindSight, 2010. Intuitive Eating was originally published in 1995. Over the years, thousands of people have read this book. While reading it, they have had a sense, at a gut level, of getting it. We've gotten many letters and emails saying, "You're writing about me," or "How did you know I felt this way?" or "Finally, someone gets it." Just as so many have gotten it, there are others who have asked what intuitive eating really means. Are we just driven by instinct? Do we just know what and how much and when to eat? In introducing this third edition, we'd like to take this opportunity to be as clear as we can in answering the question of what intuitive eating really is. Knowing a bit about the human brain can help to understand why we're born with all the wisdom we need to be intuitive eaters. It can also help us to see how we're able to live an intuitive eating life, even while being bombarded by the unending choices of natural and refined foods available to us every day, and the relentless diet messages that abound. Humans are privileged to experience a dynamic interplay of instinct, emotion, and thought, which work together to orchestrate life and are mediated by the brain. Psychiatrist and mindfulness expert Daniel Siegel, MD, calls this process MindSight. There are three regions of the brain responsible for this powerful integration. The first region is called the reptilian brain, because when the early reptiles roamed the earth, they acted and responded exclusively by instinct. They didn't rationalize or feel. They simply just went for it. As life evolved, another level of brain function developed, called the limbic brain, which mammals also possess. Emotions and social behaviors originate here. In the limbic brain, feelings are layered upon the instincts of the reptilian brain. The instincts originating from the reptilian brain are sent to the limbic brain, which serve to expand the awareness. Eventually, the third key region of the brain evolved, called the rational brain, or the neocortex. The rational brain integrates instincts and feelings from the other two brain regions. The rational brain does not control instincts. Instead, it perceives the instinctual and feeling parts of our beings and reflects upon them. The rational brain creates thoughts and language. Intuitive eating embraces all three parts of the human brain. In infancy and toddlerhood, eating is mostly instinctual. As we grow older, thoughts and feelings often play a part in our decisions about eating. As we often tell our clients, our bodies are not just composed of the tongue and the stomach, but also the mind. We have often heard someone say, "I thought that as an intuitive eater, I could eat whatever I wanted. So now I eat whatever I want and as much as I want whenever I feel like it." This comment actually distorts the premise of intuitive eating. Yes, make peace with food and eat what pleases your palate. Yes, give yourself the freedom to eat unconditionally. And eat as much as you need to satisfy your body. But eating whenever you feel like it, without regard to hunger and fullness, might not be a very satisfying experience and might also cause physical discomfort. Attunement with your body's satiety cues is an important part of this process. As an intuitive eater, you will be honoring your brain because it is part of your body. As you go through the principles of intuitive eating, you will be storing information in the memory files that you create and house in your brain. When you feel hungry, you will need to pull up several of these files while deciding what to eat. You will evaluate how hungry you feel, and then think about what foods might satisfy your hunger and your taste buds. You might even go through a series of sensual imaginings of the taste and texture and temperature of different foods. You also may open the file to reflect on past eating experiences. You might ask yourself whether your present eating choice has worked out for you when you've eaten it in the past. Did it sustain you long enough? Did it make your blood sugar crash? Did you end up with indigestion? Or did you thoroughly enjoy the food and want to have it again? Your emotions may also come into play when you have the desire to eat. Might you be upset and are craving food to comfort and soothe yourself? Or are you bored and thinking about eating as a distraction? Considering these possibilities might inform your decision of what to eat, or even whether to eat at all. In the beginning of your journey to reclaim your intuitive eater, you will probably be hyper-conscious of hunger, fullness, satisfaction, thoughts, and emotions. Your brain will need to be highly in tune with your tongue and your stomach. As you become more adept at recognizing your inner signals, you may find that your instincts and intuitive wisdom take more of a prominent role in your eating experience. So, intuitive eating is truly about trusting that you will be able to access all of the information you need to have by using all of the aspects of your brain, your reptilian instincts, your limbic connection with your emotions, and your rational thoughts. Getting back to the roots of this book, it is hard for us to believe that it has been 17 years since intuitive eating was originally published. Although the time has flown by rapidly, the years have been packed with profound experiences. We have received an innumerable number of phone calls, emails, and letters from people in all parts of the country and around the world. These communications have brought us into the lives of people we could never have known without this book. We have heard stories about how intuitive eating has changed lives and healed relationships with food and body. We have talked with people who are in the beginning of their journey and are reaching out to us for more individualized, intensive work, whether in person or by telephone. We have also received thanks from those who have used the book as a springboard for their own personal healing and have easily succeeded in the process on their own. We have been asked to refer people to nutrition therapists in other locales who are familiar with intuitive eating. We have given talks at professional meetings, as well as to students and to the lay public, and have made television appearances and been interviewed on the radio. We have been quoted in articles in newspapers, magazines, and on the Internet. Intuitive eating is being used throughout the country in numerous eating disorder treatment programs. In addition, professional colleagues have asked our permission to use intuitive eating as the basis of college lectures, workshops, and seminars of their own. The impact of all these experiences has been deeply meaningful for us. It has given us the opportunity to broaden the work that we had previously done in our offices or by telephone, working with individuals one-on-one. We have been able to extend the philosophy of intuitive eating to those whom we would have never been able to reach if not for the book. It has touched our souls to be able to hear how intuitive eating has changed the lives of so many. One of the most frequent comments that we have heard from people concerns the despair that was felt after years and years of failed dieting experiences and the new hope that blossomed after finding and reading intuitive eating. We have heard how some have cleared their minds of punitive and obsessive thoughts about their eating and body perception. This clearing has made room for positive thinking and determination to make serious life changes. Self-esteem has catapulted as people have reported the empowerment they have felt by working with a process that honors the validity of one's inner voice. Through intuitive eating, they have learned to trust the wisdom that has always been within, but has been blunted by years of self-doubt. Doubting their innate eating signals had extended to doubting their beliefs about many other aspects of their lives. We have heard stories about people who have left abusive relationships, made peace with estranged loved ones, and have made significant career changes once their struggle with food and body has been resolved. We have also heard about new romances that, for some, could not have been possible while they were occupied with body concerns and focused on the latest doomed diet attempt. Intuitive eating has freed all of these people to go on with their lives while leaving behind self-doubt and despair. Intuitive eating has also changed the lives of many of our professional colleagues. At every conference we attend, we hear comments from nutrition therapists and psychotherapists about how grateful they are to have this book to give to their patients. They tell us how it makes their lives easier, having it for use as a guidebook in their private practices, for classes they teach, and for seminars they give. We have also found in our own professional lives that having a book available, which we have written, allows our patients to take something home with them to use as a reference. We've been told that it helps some people feel that they can carry a part of us with them for support when they need it. In this third edition, there are some new additions that we hope will reach a broader base of readers and will offer some new tools for everyone. Firstly, we have added a chapter that looks at how intuitive eating works with kids and adolescents. Our goal is to help parents protect their children's inner wisdom about eating, with which they were born. We also want to give advice to parents about repairing a fractured relationship that they may have with their children around the eating experience. How wonderful it would be if all children were able to retain their inborn intuitive eating throughout their lives. Secondly, we have included a chapter on the research validating the benefits of intuitive eating. When we originally cultivated the premise of intuitive eating, we reviewed evidence from hundreds of studies, which, in addition to our clinical experience, ultimately formed the basis behind the 10 intuitive eating principles. Although our original concept is evidence-based, or more accurately said, evidence-inspired, it's really not the same thing as saying studies show that intuitive eating works. Until recently, that is. When we first wrote Intuitive Eating, we had no idea that our concept would generate many studies, which we find absolutely exciting. To date, there are over 25 studies on intuitive eating, with several that are currently underway. We have also updated the chapter on eating disorders to present our current thinking about when and how to apply intuitive eating principles in the treatment of eating disorders. We have also shifted our focus to finding satisfaction and have come to see it as a driving force in the intuitive eating process. You will see how finding satisfaction in your eating will be profoundly affected by all of the other principles in the book. Updates have also been made throughout. Over the years, we have especially become sensitive to the impact that any mention of numbers has on our readers. Whether the numbers refer to weight, height, or serving sizes and recommendations, these numbers can trigger comparison and negative feelings. So, wherever possible, numbers have been removed. In addition, be sure to check out our new Intuitive Eating Resources section, which provides information on resources, including our new Intuitive Eating online community, to give you the tools and information to further support your intuitive eating journey. We have also felt that it was very important to keep the appendix, entitled Step-by-Step Guidelines, in this version of the book. This readily accessible outline will be a boon to old and new readers as you go through this journey. If it's your first time around with a book, you can choose to read the book in its entirety and then use the outline to remind you of the whole process. Or you might decide to read about one principle at a time and then use the part of the outline that refers to that principle to fortify your focus on each step. Readers already familiar with the intuitive eating process can use this section as a way to review the entire concept and as a handy shorthand method of checking to see if they're on track. Whatever you choose, we hope that step-by-step guidelines will provide a helpful tool for you in your intuitive eating work. Finally, we would like to express our gratitude to the many people with whom we have had the honor to meet and work with over the years. You have been our teachers, even as we have counseled you on your healing path. You have inspired us to continue this work and bring out this third edition of Intuitive Eating. Thank you. Introduction. If you could cash in every diet, like a frequent flyer program, most of us would have earned a trip to the moon and back. The nearly $60 billion a year weight loss industry could finance the trip for generations to come. Ironically, we seem to have more respect for our cars than for ourselves. If you took your car to an auto mechanic for regular tune-ups, and after time and money spent, the car didn't work, you wouldn't blame yourself. Yet, in spite of the fact that 90 to 95% of all diets fail, you tend to blame yourself, not the diet. Isn't it ironic that with a massive failure rate for dieting, we don't blame the process of dieting? Initially, when we ventured into the world of private practice, we did not know each other. Yet, separately, each of us had remarkably similar counseling experiences that caused us to rethink how we work. This led to a considerable change in how we practice, and years later was the impetus for this book. Although we practiced independently of each other, unknowingly each of us got started by making a vow to avoid the trap of working with weight control. We didn't want to deal with an issue that was only set up to fail. But while we tried to avoid weight loss counseling, physicians kept referring their patients to us. Typically, their blood pressure or cholesterol was high. Whatever their medical problems, weight loss was thought to be the key to treatment. Because we wanted to help these patients, we embarked on the weight loss issue with a commitment to do it differently. Our patients would succeed. They would be among that small 5 to 10% success group. We created beautiful meal plans according to our patients' likes and dislikes, lifestyles, and specific needs. These plans were based on the widely accepted exchange system commonly used for diabetic meal planning and weight control. We told them that this was not a diet, for even back then we knew diets didn't work. We rationalized that these meal plans were not diets because patients could choose among chicken, turkey, fish, or lean meat. They could have a bagel, a muffin, or toast. If they really wanted a cookie, they could have one. Not five. They could fill up with free foods galore so they never had to feel hungry. We told them that if they had a craving for a particular food, they could go ahead and eat it without guilt. But we also reinforced gently, yet firmly, that sticking to their personalized plans would help them achieve their goals. As the weeks went by, our clients were eager to please us and followed their meal plans. We weighed them each week and, finally, their weight goals were met. Unfortunately, however, sometime later we started getting calls from some of these same people telling us how much they needed us again. Somehow the weight had come back on. Their calls were very apologetic. For some reason, they couldn't stick to the plan anymore. Maybe they needed someone to monitor them. Maybe they didn't have enough self-control. Maybe they just weren't any good at this, and definitely they felt guilty and demoralized. In spite of the failure, our patients put all the blame on themselves. After all, they trusted us. We were the great nutritionists who had helped them lose weight. Therefore, they had done something wrong, not us. As time went on, it became clear that something was very wrong with this approach. All of our good intentions were only reinforcing some very negative, self-effacing notions that our patients had about themselves. That they didn't have self-control, they couldn't do it, therefore they were bad or wrong. This led to guilt, guilt, guilt. By this time, we had both reached a turning point in the way we counseled. How could we ethically go on teaching people things that seemed logical and nutritionally sound, yet triggered such emotional upheaval? Yet, on the other hand, how could we neglect an area of treatment that could have such a profound effect on a patient's future health? As we struggled with these issues, we began to explore some of the popular literature that suggested a 180-degree departure from dieting. It proposed a way of eating that allowed for any and all food choices without regard for nutrition. Our initial reactions were highly skeptical, if not downright rejecting. We reacted with self-righteous indignation. How could we, as nutritionists, registered dietitians, trained to look at the connections between nutrition and health, sanction a way of eating that seemed to reject the very foundation of our knowledge and philosophy? The struggle continued. The healthy meal plans were not helping people maintain permanent weight control, yet the throw-out nutrition approach was a dangerous option. The suggestion to ignore nutrition and disregard how the body feels in response to eating whatever you want discounts the respect for one's body that comes along with a gift of life. Eventually, we resolved the conflict by developing the intuitive eating process. This book is a bridge between the growing anti-diet movement and the health community. While the anti-dieting movement shuns dieting and hails body acceptance, thankfully, it often fails to address health risks. How do you reconcile forbidden food issues and still eat healthfully while not dieting? We will tell you how in this book. If you are like most of our clients, you are weary of dieting and yet terrified of eating. Most of our clients are uncomfortable in their bodies, but don't know how to change. Intuitive eating provides a new way of eating that is ultimately struggle-free and healthy for your mind and body. It is a process that unleashes the shackles of dieting, which can only lead to deprivation, rebellion, and rebound weight gain. It means getting back to your roots, trusting your body and its signals. Intuitive eating will not only change your relationship with food, it may change your life. We hope you find that intuitive eating will make a difference in your life. It has for our clients. In fact, when our clients learned that we were writing this book, they wanted to share some specific turning points with you. Be sure to tell them that if they have a binge, it can actually turn out to be a great experience because they'll learn so much about their thoughts and feelings as a result of the binge. Tell them that taking a time out to see if they're hungry doesn't mean that they can't eat if they find they're not hungry. It's just a time out to make sure that they're not eating on autopilot. If they want to eat anyway, they can. When I come to a session, I feel as if I'm going to the priest for confession. That comes from all the times I used to go to the diet doctor, and I would have to tell him how I had sinned after he had weighed me. This isn't coming from you, but the inner food police. I feel like I'm out of prison. I'm free, and not thinking about food all the time anymore. Sometimes I get angry because food has lost its magic. Nothing tastes quite as good as it did when it was forbidden. I kept looking for the old thrill that food used to give me, until I realized that my excitement in life wasn't going to come from my eating anymore. With permission comes choice. And making choices based on what I want and not on what somebody else is telling me feels so empowering. After giving up binging, I ended up feeling pretty low some of the time and even rageful at other times. I realized that the food was covering up my bad feelings, but it was also covering up my good feelings. I'd rather feel good and bad rather than not feeling at all. When I saw how much I was using dieting and eating to cope with life, I realized that I had to change some of the stress in my life if I ever wanted to let go of food as a coping mechanism. Sometimes I have hungry days, and sometimes I have full days. It's so nice to eat more sometimes and not feel guilty that I'm going against some plan. I get so exhilarated when I see a food I used to restrict. Now I think, it's free, it's there, and it's mine. I'm so glad you're writing this book. It will help me explain what I'm doing. All I know is that it works. When I'm in the diet mentality, I can't think about the real problems in my life. This is the best I've ever taken care of myself in my life. Mindful eating versus intuitive eating. Is there a difference? When the first edition of Intuitive Eating was published in 1995, the term mindful eating was not in the public vernacular. Consequently, we used the term conscious eating to describe the process of being aware while eating. 4 years later, in 1999, the first mindful eating study was published. Chris Diller and Hallett, 1999. We actually now often use the term mindful eating because it has become commonly used and practiced. The Center for Mindful Eating states that mindfulness in eating includes allowing yourself to become aware of the positive and nurturing opportunities that are available through food preparation and consumption by respecting your own inner wisdom. Choosing to eat food that is both pleasing to you and nourishing to your body by using all your senses to explore, savor, and taste. Acknowledging responses to food, likes, neutral, or dislikes, without judgment. Learning to be aware of physical hunger and satiety, cues to guide your decision to begin eating and to stop eating. While intuitive eating includes the principles of mindful eating, it also encompasses a broader philosophy, addressing the issues of cognitive distortions and emotional eating. It includes seeing satisfaction as a focal point in eating, physical activity, movement for the sake of feeling good, rejecting the dieting mentality, using nutrition information without judgment, and respecting your body, regardless of how you feel about its shape. Intuitive eating is a dynamic process, integrating attunement of mind, body, and food. For those who struggle with eating issues, both mindful eating and intuitive eating can help facilitate normal eating. Chapter 1. Hitting Diet Bottom. I just can't go on another diet. You're my last resort. Sandra had been dieting all her life and knew she could no longer endure a single diet. She'd been on them all, Atkins, Dukan, The Zone, South Beach, Grapefruit Diet, diets too numerous to itemize. Sandra was a dieting pro. At first, dieting was fun, even exhilarating. I always thought this diet would be different, this time. And so the cycle would recharge with each new diet, each and every summer. But the weight loss would eventually rebound like an unwanted tax bill. Sandra had hit diet bottom. By now, however, she was more obsessed about food and her body than ever. She felt silly. I should have had this dealt with and controlled long ago. What she didn't realize was that it was the process of dieting that had done this to her. Dieting had made her more preoccupied with food. Dieting had made food the enemy. Dieting had made her feel guilty when she wasn't eating diet types of foods, even when she wasn't officially dieting. Dieting had slowed her metabolism. It took years for Sandra to truly know dieting doesn't work. Yes, she was familiar with the emerging concept that dieting doesn't work, but she always thought she would be different. While most experts and consumers accept the premise that fad diets don't work, it's tough for a nation of people obsessed with their bodies to believe that even sensible dieting is futile. Sandra had been hooked into modern age social mythology, the big diet hope, for most of her life, since her first diet at the age of 14. By the age of 30, Sandra felt stuck. She still wanted to lose weight and was uncomfortable in her body. While Sandra couldn't bear the thought of another diet, she didn't realize that most of her food issues were actually caused by her dieting. Sandra was also frustrated and angry. I know everything about diets. Indeed, she could recite calories and fat grams like a walking nutritional database. That's the big caveat. Losing weight and keeping it off is not usually a knowledge issue. If all we needed to be normal weight was knowledge about food and nutrition, most Americans wouldn't have weight problems. The information is readily available. Pick up any women's magazine and you'll find diets and food comparisons galore. Also, the harder you try to diet, the harder you fall. It really hurts not to succeed if you did everything right. The best description for this effect is given by John Forright, Ph.D., a noted expert in dieting psychology. He likened it to a Chinese finger puzzle, the hollow cylindrical straw puzzle into which you insert an index finger on each end. The harder you try to get out, the more pressure you exert, the more difficult it is to get out of the puzzle. Instead, you find yourself locked in tighter, trapped, frustrated. Symptoms of diet backlash. Diet backlash is the cumulative side effect of dieting. It can be short-term or chronic, depending on how long a person has been dieting. It may be just one side effect or several. By the time Sandra came to the office, she had the classic symptoms of diet backlash. Not only diet weary, she was eating less food, yet had trouble losing weight during her more recent diet attempts. Other symptoms included, the mere contemplation of going on a diet brings on urges and cravings for sinful foods and fatty favorites, such as ice cream, chocolate, cookies, and so forth. Upon ending a diet, going on a food binge and feeling guilty. One study indicated that post-dieting binges occur in 49% of all people who end a diet. Having little trust in self with food. Understandably, every diet has taught you not to trust your body or the food you put in it. Even though it is the process of dieting that fails you, the failure continues to undermine your relationship with food. Feeling that you don't deserve to eat because you're overweight. Shortened dieting duration. The lifespan of a diet gets shorter and shorter. Is it no wonder that Ultra Slim Fast's sales pitch is, give us a week and we'll... The Last Supper. Every diet is preceded by consuming foods you presume you won't eat again. Food consumption often goes up during this time. It may occur over one meal or over a couple of days. The Last Supper seems to be the final step before dietary cleansing, almost a farewell-to-food party. For one client, Marilyn, every meal felt as if it were her last. She would eat each meal until she was uncomfortably stuffed, as she was terrified she would never eat again. For good reason. She had been dieting since the sixth grade, over two-thirds of her life. She had attempted periods of fasting and a series of low-calorie diets. As far as her body was concerned, a diet was only around the corner, so better eat while you can. Each meal for Marilyn was famine relief. Social withdrawal. Since it's hard to stay on a diet and go to a party or out to dinner, it just becomes easier to turn down social invitations. At first, social food avoidance may seem like the wise thing to do for the good of the diet, but it escalates into a bigger problem. There's often a fear of being able to stay in control. It's not uncommon for this experience to be reinforced by saving up the calories or fat grams for the party, which usually means eating very little. By the time the dieter arrives at the party, ravenous hunger dominates, and eating feels very out of control. Sluggish metabolism. Each diet teaches the body to adapt better for the next self-imposed famine, another diet. Metabolism slows as the body efficiently utilizes each calorie as if it's the last. The more drastic the diet, the more it pushes the body into the calorie-pinching survival mode. Fueling metabolism is like stoking a fire. Remove the wood and the fire diminishes. Similarly, to fuel metabolism, we must eat a sufficient amount of calories, or our bodies will compensate and slow down. Using caffeine to survive the day. Coffee and diet drinks are often abused as management tools to feel energetic while being underfed. Eating disorders. Finally, for some, repeated dieting is often the stepping stone to an eating disorder, ranging from anorexia nervosa or bulimia to compulsive overeating. Although Sandra felt she could never diet again, she still engaged in the Last Supper phenomenon. We regularly encounter this when we see someone for the first time. She literally ate higher quantities of food than usual and ate plenty of her favorite foods. She thought she would never see these foods again. It's as if she were getting ready for a long trip and was packing extra clothes. Just the thought of working on her food issues put her into the pre-diet mentality, a common occurrence. While Sandra was just beginning to understand the futility of dieting, her desire to be thin had not changed, clearly a dilemma. She held on to the allure of the noble American dream. The dieting paradox. In our society, the pursuit of thinness, whether for health or physique, has become the battle cry of seemingly every American. Eating a single morsel of any high-fat or non-nutritionally redeeming food is punishable by a life sentence of guilt by association. You may be paroled, however, for good behavior. Good behavior in our society means starting a new diet or having good intentions to diet. And so begins the deprivation cycle of dieting, the battle of the bulge and the indulge. Rice cakes one week, Haagen-Dazs the next. I feel guilty just letting the grocery clerk see what I buy, lamented another client, who happened to have her cart stocked with fruits, vegetables, whole grains, pasta, and a small pint of real ice cream. It's as if we live in a food police state run by the food mafia, and there always seems to be a dieting offer you can't refuse. Exaggeration? No. There's a good reason for this perception. A study published in 1993 in Eating Disorders, the Journal of Treatment and Prevention, found that between 1973 and 1991, commercials for dieting aids, diet food, reducing aids, and diet program foods increased nearly linearly. The researchers also noted that there is a parallel trend in the occurrence of eating disorders. They speculate that the media pressure to diet, via commercials, is a major influence in the eating disorder trend. The pressure to diet is fueled beyond television commercials. Magazine articles and movies contribute to the pressure to be slim. Even subtle cigarette billboards aim for the female Achilles heel, weight, with names such as Ultra Slim 100, Virginia Slims, and so on. A Kent cigarette, Slim Lights, especially characterizes this tug on women's body issues. Their ad reads more like a commercial for a weight loss center than for a cigarette, by highlighting slender descriptions, long, lean, light. Of course, the models in cigarette ads are especially slender. It is no surprise that the Center for Disease Control, CDC, attributed an increase in smoking by women to their desire to be thinner. Sadly, we have heard women contemplate in our offices that they too have considered taking up smoking again as a weight loss aid. But weight loss is not just a women's issue, although clearly there's added pressure on women. The proliferation of light beer commercials has planted the seed of body consciousness in men's minds as well. A lean belly is better than a beer belly. It's no coincidence we've seen the launch of magazines aimed at men, such as Men's Fitness and Men's Health. While the pursuit of leanness has crossed over the gender barrier, sadly, we have given birth to the first generation of Weight Watchers. A disturbing new dieting trend is affecting the health of U.S. children. Shocking studies have demonstrated that school-aged children are obsessing about their weight, a reflection of a nation obsessed with diet and weight. Around the country, children as young as 6 years old are shedding pounds, afraid of being fat, and are increasingly being treated for eating disorders that threaten their health and growth. Societal pressure to be thin has backfired on children. Dieting not only does not work, it is at the root of many problems. While many may diet as an attempt to lose weight or for health reasons, the paradox is that it may cause more harm. Here's what our nation has to show for dieting. Obesity is higher than ever in adults and children. Eating disorders are on the rise. Childhood obesity has doubled over the last decade. Even though there are more fat-free and diet foods than ever before, nearly two-thirds of adults are overweight or obese. Over 1,200 tons of fat have been liposuctioned from 1982 to 1992. A recent study showed that only 1 year after having a liposuction procedure, the fat returned, but to a different part of the body. Dieting increases your chance of gaining even more weight than you lost. Dieting can't fight biology. Dieting is a form of short-term starvation. Consequently, when you are given the first opportunity to really eat, eating is often experienced at such intensity that it feels uncontrollable, a desperate act. In the moment of biological hunger, all intentions to diet and the desire to be thin are fleeting and, paradoxically, irrelevant. In those moments, we become like the insatiable man-eating plant in the movie Little Shop of Horrors, demanding to eat. Feed me! Feed me! While intense eating may feel out of control and unnatural, it is a normal response to starving and dieting. Yet so often, post-diet eating is viewed as having no willpower or a character defect. But when you interpret post-diet eating as such, it slowly erodes trust in yourself with food, diet after diet. Every diet violation, every eating situation that feels out of control, lays the foundation for the diet mentality, brick by brick and diet by diet. The seemingly brave solution, try harder next time, becomes as bewildering as the Chinese finger puzzle. You can't fight biology. When the body is starving, it needs to be nourished. Yet so often a dieter laments, "If only I had the willpower." Clearly, this is not an issue of willpower, although glowing testimonials from weight loss clinics foster this misplaced blame on willpower. When underfed, you will obsess about food, whether from a self-imposed diet or starvation. Maybe you don't diet, but eat vigilantly in the name of health and fitness. This seems to be the politically correct term for dieting in the 90s. But for many, it's the same food issue, with the same symptoms. Avoiding fat or carbohydrates at all costs, and subsisting virtually on fat-free or carbohydrate-free foods is essentially dieting, and often results in being underfed. There are many forms of dieting and many types of dieters. We will explore your dieting personality and meet the intuitive eater in the next chapter. Dieting increases your risk for gaining more weight. If dieting programs had to stand up to the same scrutiny as medications, they would never be allowed for public consumption. Imagine, for example, taking an asthma medication, which improves your breathing for a few weeks, but in the long run causes your lungs and breathing to worsen. Would you really embark on a diet, even a so-called sensible diet, if you knew that it could cause you to gain more weight? Here are some sobering studies indicating that dieting promotes weight gain. A team of UCLA researchers reviewed 31 long-term studies on dieting and concluded that dieting is a consistent predictor of weight gain. Up to two-thirds of the people regained more weight than they lost. Research on nearly 17,000 kids ages 9 to 14 years old concluded, in the long term, dieting to control weight is not only ineffective, it may actually promote weight gain. Teenage dieters had twice the risk of becoming overweight compared to non-dieting teens, according to a 5-year study. Notably, at baseline, the dieters did not weigh more than their non-dieting peers. This is an important detail, because if the dieters weighed more, it would be a confounding factor, which would implicate other factors rather than dieting, such as genetics. A novel study on over 2,000 sets of twins from Finland, aged 16 to 25 years old, showed that dieting itself, independent of genetics, is significantly associated with accelerated weight gain and increased risk of becoming overweight. Dieting twins, who embarked on just one intentional weight loss episode, were nearly 2 to 3 times more likely to become overweight compared to their non-dieting twin counterpart. Furthermore, the risk of becoming overweight increased in a dose-dependent manner with each dieting episode. Studies aside, what have your own dieting experiences shown you? Many of our patients and workshop participants say their first diet was easy. The pounds just melted off. But that first dieting experience is the seduction trap, which launches the futile pursuit of weight loss via dieting. We say futile because our bodies are very smart and wired for survival. Biologically, your body experiences the dieting process as a form of starvation. Your cells don't know you are voluntarily restricting your food intake. Your body shifts into primal survival mode. Metabolism slows down and food cravings escalate. And with each diet, the body learns and adapts, resulting in rebound weight gain. Consequently, many of our patients feel like they are a failure. But it is dieting that has failed them. Chapter 2. What kind of eater are you? Perhaps you are still dieting and don't know it. There are many types of eating styles that are actually unconscious forms of dieting. Many of our patients have said they were not on a diet, but upon closer inspection of what and how they eat, they were still dieting. Here's a good example. Ted came because he wanted to lose weight. He said that in his 50 years of living, he had been on only 4 serious diets. When perusing the book titles in the office, compulsive overeating texts, eating disorder books, and so forth, he stated, "You work with a lot of serious dieting problems." "Well, I'm not one of those." Ted clearly did not see himself as a dieter, merely a careful eater. Yet it turned out that he was an unconscious dieter. Although Ted was not actively dieting, he was under-eating to a level where he was nearly passing out in the afternoon. The reason? He had always been unhappy with his weight. In the mornings, he would go for an intense hilly bike ride for 1 hour, come home, and eat a small breakfast. Lunch was usually salad with iced tea. While this sounds healthy, it's too low in carbohydrates. By supper time, his body would be screaming for food. Ted was not only in a severe calorie deficit, but also carbohydrate deprived. Evenings turned into a food fest. Ted had thought he had a food volume problem with a strong sweet tooth. In reality, he had an unconscious diet mentality that biologically triggered his night eating and sweet tooth. Alicia also was not a conscious dieter. She came in not to lose weight, but because she wanted to increase her energy level. During the initial session, it became clear that she had complicated issues with food. So she was asked if she had been dieting a lot. She looked astonished. "How did you know I've been on zillions of diets?" While Alicia claimed to be okay with her current weight, she was still at war with food. She didn't trust herself with food. As it turns out, Alicia had been dieting since she was a child. Although she was not officially dieting, she retained and expanded a set of food rules with each diet that nearly paralyzed her ability to eat normally. We see this all the time. The hangover from dieting, avoiding certain foods at all costs, feeling out of control the moment a sinful food is eaten, feeling guilty when self-imposed food rules are broken, such as thou shalt not eat past 6 p.m., and so on. Unconscious dieting usually occurs in the form of meticulous eating habits. There can be a fine line between eating for health and dieting. Notice how even the frozen diet foods, such as Lean Cuisine and Weight Watchers, are putting their emphasis on health rather than diet. As long as you are engaged in some form of dieting, you won't be free from food and body worries. Whether you are a conscious or an unconscious dieter, the side effects are similar, the diet backlash effect. This is characterized by periods of careful eating, blowing it, and paying penance with more dieting or extra careful eating. In this chapter, we will explore the various dieting eating styles to help see where you are now. Later, you will meet the intuitive eater and the intuitive eating style, the solution to living without diets. The eating personalities. To help you clarify your eating style, or dieting style, we have identified the following key categories of eaters that exhibit characteristic eating patterns: the careful eater, the professional dieter, and the unconscious eater. These eating personalities are exhibited even when not officially dieting. It's possible to have more than one eating personality, although we find that there tends to be a dominant trait. Events in your life can also influence or shift your eating personality. For example, one client, a tax attorney, was normally a careful eater. But during tax season, he became the chaotic, unconscious eater. You may find yourself occasionally possessing the eating characteristics described under the three core eating personalities. Take note of this. And if your eating exists in one of these domains most of the time, it can be a problem. Listen to each eating personality and see which one best reflects your eating style. By understanding where you are now, it will become easier to learn how to become an intuitive eater. For example, you may find you have been engaged in a form of dieting and not even have been aware of it. Or you may discover traits that unknowingly work against you. The careful eater. Careful eaters are those who tend to be vigilant about what foods they put into their bodies. Ted was an example of a careful eater. By day. On the surface, careful eaters appear to be perfect eaters. They are highly nutrition conscious. Outwardly, they seem health and fitness oriented. Noble traits, admired and reinforced in our society. Eating style. There is a range of food behaviors that the careful eater exhibits. At one extreme, the careful eater may anguish over each morsel of food allowed into the body. Grocery shopping trips are spent scrutinizing food labels. Eating out often means interrogating the waiter. What's in the food? How is the food prepared? And getting assurances that the food is prepared specifically to the careful eater's liking. Usually not one speck of oil or other fat used. What's wrong with this? Aren't label reading and assertive restaurant ordering in the health interests of some people? Of course. The difference, however, is the intensity of the vigilance and the ability to let go of any guilt in regard to your eating choice. Careful eaters tend to undereat and monitor the quantity of food eaten. The careful eater can spend most of his or her waking hours planning out the next meal or snack, often worrying about what to eat. While the careful eater is not officially on a diet, his or her mind is, chastising every unhealthy, fatty, or sugary food eaten. The careful eater can run the fine line between being genuinely interested in health and eating carefully for the sake of body image. Sometimes the careful eater is guided by time or events. For example, some careful eaters are meticulous during the weekdays, so that they earn their eating right to splurge on the weekends or for an upcoming party. But weekends occur 104 days of the year. The splurges can backfire with unwanted weight gain. Consequently, it's not unusual for a careful eater to contemplate going on a diet. The problem. There's nothing wrong with being interested in the well-being of your body. The problem occurs, however, when diligent eating, almost bordering on militant, affects a healthy relationship with food and negatively impacts your body. Careful eaters, upon closer inspection, resemble a subtle dieter style. They may not diet, but they scrutinize every food situation. The professional dieter. Professional dieters are easier to identify. They are perpetually dieting. They have usually tried the latest commercial diet, diet book, or new weight loss gimmick. Sometimes dieting takes place in the form of fasting or cutting back. Professional dieters know a lot about portions of foods, calories, and dieting tricks. Yet the reason they are always on another diet is that the original one never worked. Today, the professional dieter is also well-versed in counting carbohydrate grams. Eating style. Professional dieters also have careful eating traits. The difference, however, is that chronic dieters guide every eating choice for the sake of losing weight, not necessarily health. When the dieter is not officially on a diet, he or she is usually thinking about the next diet that can be started. She often wakes up hoping this will be a good day, the new beginning. While professional dieters have a lot of dieting knowledge, it doesn't serve them well. It's not unusual for them to binge or engage in Last Supper eating the moment a forbidden food is eaten. That's because chronic dieters truly believe they will not eat this food again. For tomorrow they diet. Tomorrow they start over with a clean slate. Better eat now, it's the last chance. Not surprisingly, the professional dieter gets frustrated at the futility of the vicious cycle. Diet, lose weight, gain weight, intermittent binges, and back to dieting. The problem. It's hard to live this way. Yo-yo dieting makes it increasingly difficult to lose weight, let alone eat healthfully. Chronic undereating usually results in overeating or periodic binges. For some professional dieters, the frustration of losing weight becomes so intensified that they may try laxatives, diuretics, and diet pills. And because these diet aids do not work, they may try extreme methods such as chronic restricting in the form of anorexia nervosa or purging such as throwing up after a binge in the form of bulimia. While anorexia and bulimia are multifactorial and rooted in psychological issues, a growing body of research has demonstrated that chronic dieting is a common stepping stone into an eating disorder. One study in particular found that by the time dieters reach the age of 15 years, they are 8 times as likely to suffer from an eating disorder as non-dieters. The unconscious eater. The unconscious eater is often engaged in paired eating, which is eating and doing another activity at the same time, such as watching television and eating, or reading and eating. Because of the subtleties and lack of awareness, it can be difficult for a person to identify this eating personality. There are many subtypes of unconscious eaters. The chaotic unconscious eater often lives an overscheduled life, too busy, too many things to do. The chaotic eating style is haphazard. Whatever's available will be grabbed. Vending machine fare, fast food, it'll all do. Nutrition and diet are often important to this person, just not in the critical moment of the chaos. Chaotic eaters are often so busy putting out fires that they have difficulty identifying biological hunger until it's fiercely ravenous. Not surprisingly, The chaotic eater goes long periods of time without eating. The refuse not unconscious eater is vulnerable to the mere presence of food, regardless if hungry or full. Candy jars, food lying around at meetings,